is not for newbies and not so newbies. It's primarily a tutorial. If you're looking for something else, you're in the wrong room. Before we get started, a couple of things I want to do rather quickly here. Something I've always sort of wanted to do with a crowd like this, a special sort of DDoS, distributed denial of service thing. So everyone who has a cell phone, please take it out. We're going to try something here. Take your cell phone out, hold it up in one hand. Everybody, if you didn't bring a cell phone, you're a loser. Hold it up. Hold that cell phone up. Okay, step one, just for a moment, turn the power off. Turn the power off. Okay, step two, put it in your pocket and leave it there for an hour. That's the world's first do-it-yourself distributed self-denial of service. Second issue, some of you have been and know that there's this Spot the Fed contest. And before 200 of you out there try to claim a free t-shirt on my appearance, I'm not a Fed, never have been. It's really hot out. Works so well. I know I got a monogram shirt on, but I got white socks and red Converse All-Star high tops on, so I couldn't be a Fed. So just thought I'd straighten that out. Hope this continues to work. Bad batteries? All right. So, how about this one? All right. Uh-oh. Let's see it. Who's got that phone? All right, we're going to talk about NAT, which is Network Address Translation. I've been working with firewalls for a few years, primarily Checkpoint Firewall 1. But network address translation is valuable with almost any firewall or almost any setup. I chose this topic because, in my opinion, it's sort of ignored. I think NAT is really useful. It's essentially free. It does all sorts of cool stuff. It gives you all sorts of protections. It's a really valuable thing, in my opinion. And I, looking at the firewall literature, I thought it wasn't being covered very well. So I'm sort of an amateur at this. But I think NAT speaks well for itself here. And so this is going to be two 50-minute sessions. We're going to go until 3:50 p.m., take a 10-minute break, come back at 4. I'm eager for questions. This is a tutorial. The whole point here is that you learn and that you enjoy yourselves. So please, don't even do that raise your hand thing. I grew up in New Jersey. It's okay to just shout out, yo, at the top of your lungs. That's not an insult. I'll be glad to stop and answer questions. I'm going to run through a quick introduction. I don't know exactly when the break is going to occur here. We're going to talk about some basics of network address translation. I'm going to show you a typical NAT configuration. I'm going to draw it here on the world's smallest whiteboard. We're going to discuss NAT in action. I'm going to go over some of the benefits. There are some special firewall configurations that I'm going to discuss. Those of you who have done network address translation know that there are some special DNS issues. If a single TCP/IP host has multiple IP addresses, it's an interesting question, which IP address should your DNS server return? We'll talk about that. Quick summary, lots of Q&A, but please don't save your questions till the end. Let's hear them as we go along. Some of you, this talk is on the newbie track, so some of you may be wondering, you know, am I well enough qualified for this? Is this over my head? Is this basic stuff that's going to bore me? If you know some of these basic concepts, you're going to be plenty well qualified for it. So if you've done some basic TCP/IP stuff, you should be just fine. If you've ever done any of these, you're more than qualified to benefit from this tutorial. How many people here have configured a TCP/IP host, router, or firewall? Knowingly configured one? Thank you. Connected some LAN users to the internet? Debugged an internet connectivity problem? Okay, be careful now. Brought down Yahoo with a DDoS attack? Okay, just a few of you. Here is one possible definition of NAT. I couldn't find anything official or formal on the internet anywhere, so I'm sort of making this up. The assigning of two different IP addresses to the same TCP/IP host, a public one to be used when accessing the host from inside the security perimeter, and a private one to be used when accessing the host from outside the security perimeter. So as you all probably know, the basic concept of NAT is that you establish a security perimeter around your organization and use different IP addresses on the inside and on the outside. You need a network address translation box, a NAT box, sitting on the perimeter in order to do the intelligent translations back and forth. But this is the basic concept. If you have a better definition, I'd like to hear it, but I think this works pretty well. Some basics. We're going to talk about RFC 1918, the concept of private IP addresses, and two general modes of operation for NAT. You've all probably heard of, by now, the Internet Engineering Task Force. They archive these things called RFCs. They are requests for comments. This is the, I guess, democratic, unstructured way that the Internet has developed. Somebody comes up with a bright idea and posts publicly a request for comment. Basically, what they're saying is, I think this is a good idea. I think this is the way the world should do things. I assert this is the best we've got, and I'm posting this for comments. And only after it's been subjected to perhaps withering public scrutiny do people sort of generally agree that, yeah, this works. And so most of the internet, the specifications have been designated and cleared up and archived in these RFCs. The famous one for us in terms of network address translation is 1918. Anybody who knows NAT, anybody who can tell you the story about those funny IP addresses, 192.168. How many people here have seen a strange look? I've seen some addresses, 192.168, and you know there's something funny about them, but you're not quite sure what it is. Hands, thank you. So, in 1918, address allocation for private internet discusses some of this, but not all of it. You can find them all at IETF.org. There's all sorts of great stuff. On a boring, rainy afternoon, it's a terrific way to learn some more things about the internet. Okay, so let's talk about private IP addresses. On the bottom row there, you see the 192.168. Now, early in your careers, when messing with TCP/IP and routing issues, you quickly figured out that there was something different and strange and special about those IP addresses. If you were paying attention, you figured out that they couldn't route out to the internet. These are three different classes of IP address blocks that have been reserved and are private. One of them is a Class A block, the 10s. So if you ever see any IP addresses starting with 10, you know that these are private. They're non-routable on the internet. We'll talk about some of these special characteristics here in a minute. This is particularly nice because you've got 16 million IP addresses, and you can use this no matter how big your organization is. You can use the 10 block to help get things structured internally. The Class B blocks, which are the toughest trivia question here, ask somebody what are the Class B private address blocks, 172.16 through 172.31. There are 16 Class B blocks available, each of which has 64,000 IP addresses, and there are 256 Class C blocks, each of which has 256 IP addresses. So you should know, if you ever see any host with these IP addresses, that there's something special going on. These are private IP addresses. They are non-routable on the internet, and we'll talk about some of the special characteristics here. These private addresses are reserved and that they'll never be assigned to someone in the global internet routing scheme. There is no host out there at 192.168 on the internet somewhere. None. There are none. In fact, every router on the internet is required to drop all packets addressed to any IP address in these blocks. So you don't have to worry about it. So if you're on your corporate LAN and you know there's a web server that you're using at 10.1.1.1, what does that say to you? Well, the immediate conclusion you can come to is that, well, that must be internal to my corporation somewhere, because you know for a fact it can't be over the internet because you can't get to it. So it's nice that you never have to worry about a collision. You never have to worry about, well, if I make my host 10.1.1.1, oh no, have I just screwed up my routing tables? You know, what if there is a 10.1.1.1 out there? I'm never going to be able to reach them now because, you know, I'm going to be routing back to myself. So one of the benefits of having private IP addresses is you can use them all you want internally, and you have no fear that you're going to screw up your routing tables and find yourself colliding with something that's legitimate and valid out on the internet, because you know for a fact it's not. Packets with a private address destination are dropped by internet routers, and we're going to talk about one of the benefits of this in the future. If one of your internal machines that you don't want people on the internet to have access to has one of these private IP addresses, it's a lot harder for someone on the internet to connect to it, because any packets that a hacker sends to 192.168, as soon as they get out on the internet, they're going to be dropped, right? This is even better than an access control list. This is, I don't have an address you can get to. Anyone can use them internally, as they'll never collide with external addresses. Okay, we've talked about RFC 1918 and some private addresses. If you've been playing with network address translation, you've probably seen that in most firewalls, in particular here, the Checkpoints Firewall 1, if you notice here I'm sort of using some other terminology, well, I am. There are two modes, generally speaking, for network address translation. Hide mode, otherwise known as many-to-one, or static mode, which is one-to-one. And this is largely because when it comes to granting internet access in your organization, you can pretty much partition all of your TCP/IP hosts into two groups, those of which should have some access by people on the internet, you know, your mail server, right, your web server, your FTP server, and those that you never want anyone on the internet to have access to, your payroll server, the accounting server, your workstation, say. I'm speaking only of connections coming from the internet in, not connections going from the inside out. So if you're like most organizations, you can partition all of your TCP/IP hosts, you know, all but five of them. You want to be internal and protected. For the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to call that the LAN, the local area network. And then there's maybe four or five servers, or hundreds if you're a big content provider. And you're going to want those to be allowed at least some access from people on the internet. And I'm going to call that the DMZ, demilitarized zone, which is sort of not very descriptive, but it's a special zone, perhaps it's even a special nick off of your firewall on a protected subnet, in which you're allowing some access by people on the internet. Very filtered, very specific, very carefully monitored access, but you are allowing some access. But the machines on the inside, like, you know, the woman who does payroll, her laptop, you know, her desktop machine, you don't want people on the outside to be able to connect to that under any circumstances. So those go in the LAN, and they'll be in something called hide mode. Static mode, or one-to-one, is what you typically do for servers, machines that you wish to make available to the public. So if you're, the moral of the story is, if you're going to set up NAT in your organization, one of the first things you need to do is basically think about all your TCP/IP hosts and partition them into two groups, mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive, and figure out which ones go in the DMZ and which ones go in the LAN. And that'll help you figure out which mode to use. Okay, so we've talked about the first section here. Let's have some questions. I've talked about RFC 1918. I've talked about private IP addresses. I've talked about two modes of network address translation. Questions? Things I've screwed up on? Yes?
How would that work in a VPN situation?
The question is, how would NAT work in a VPN situation? The short answer is, with great difficulty. It's a real problem. I believe IPsec embeds the IP address of a host, and that goes out. It's some problems. I don't know a whole lot more than that that I can share with you at this point, but yes, there's some real difficulties if you're trying to use a VPN with NAT. Because NAT, the host and the server, or the two ends of the connection using NAT, basically don't need to and perhaps cannot be aware of the fact that network address translation was used. We'll show here. I'm going to go through some descriptions here and walk through with packets. And I'm going to show that both, for example, if you're browsing the web with a client using network address translation, neither side is even aware that NAT is going on. So for most protocols that operate with good manners and don't embed IP addresses in the payload, then NAT works just fine. But one of the security aspects of some VPN protocols is that in order to prevent various attacks, et cetera, they embed the IP address in the payload, and that can cause some problems. The best way to solve this problem is to have the VPN and your firewall working together. For example, Checkpoint Firewall 1, the example I know, I'm not trying to plug them, they do that well. You can mix the VPN with network address translation. Other questions? Okay, this is a typical NAT configuration. This is a highly stylized, simple network. This is your new .com company 2 years ago. They've been in business for 2 weeks. The Big Eye Internet, we have a gateway router. It's your Cisco 1700 or your Cisco 3600, whatever it is. You're running a firewall there with NAT, and you'll see that there are two separate NICs coming out of that firewall. I'm really trying to separate those two LAN segments to the greatest degree possible. On the lower right, we have the DMZ, and you'll see we've got a World Wide Web server, we have a mail server, and an FTP server. And those machines are in the DMZ because we do want people on the internet to have some limited access to those machines. On the lower left-hand side is the LAN, and there's the server there and various users. And again, the purpose is we don't want anyone on the internet to have any access to the people in the LAN. So we've already done this partitioning. We've already got it split out here into two separate subnets with two separate policies. The one on the lower right is using static mode NAT. The one on the lower left is using hide mode NAT. Question? The question is, what if your router does your NAT for you? Can you still split it up into two different modes? Okay, the question is particularly about low-end Cisco routers. I don't know. If there's a single NIC coming out on the bottom of the router, then it makes it a lot harder, obviously, to split it into two NICs. Put a switch underneath it and do the best you can. You know, the point of security is not to be perfect. It's just to put up, as many sort of walls to climb over as you can. One of the purposes of splitting it into two different NICs is it's like those lizards in the deserts of Arizona who have those big tails. And if a predator grabs the tail, well, the tail breaks off and the lizard gets away. And the DMZ is sort of the lizard's tail here because you are allowing some access from the internet. There is still some chance of somebody taking over one of your servers. And so you set up your routing rules and the firewall rules in such a way that even if somebody takes over your web server, they still can't get into the LAN. Okay, this is the whole reason why you use two separate subnets and have two separate policies here. You know, obviously nobody wants to get their web server taken over, but if it does, well, okay, you can flatten that hard drive and start over. But at no time did they have enhanced access to get back into the LAN and get into your payroll server, which is the real concern. So that's the motivation behind having these two different LAN segments. The question is that some routers will do specific port forwarding, limiting certain limiting packets destined for certain ports only to certain IP addresses. That sounds like an access control list or basic firewall configuration issues. Matt, in action. All right, we're going to, I wanted to have a little icon here of a guy named Nat, and I was going to use him as a little animated something stupid here, but with my lame amateur PowerPoint skills, you've been saved. So we're gonna look here. There are four possibilities. We're going to look here at hide mode and static mode. There's another cell phone. And we're going to look at outbound connections and inbound connections and see what happens. Okay, the first thing we're going to do here is talk about what's inside an IP packet. I could spend 4 days talking about what's inside an IP packet. I'm just going to mention a couple of basic fundamental things that you need to know for network address translation. You can get a PhD in IP packetology, I'm sure, from somewhere. Two of the most important things are the IP source address. Every TCP/IP packet that goes anywhere contains the source address of the machine where it came from. Or, if you spoof it, it can contain any IP address you want. But let's start with normal expected IP packets, which have the IP address of the TCP/IP host that sent the packet. Another thing it also contains is the destination. You wouldn't be able to route the packet over your network or over the internet if it didn't have an address where it wants to go. So this is like a letter you're throwing in the mail, or I guess in the example of the internet, the canonical example, it's a postcard you're throwing in the mail, and this postcard has a to address and it has a from address. You already know that. This is simple stuff. Something else that it has is a port number. Those of you who know the OSI model, this is layer 4, this is the transport layer. For example, these are port numbers you've heard about. If you're talking to a web server, it's port 80 HTTP. If you're talking to an FTP server, it's port 21. Outbound email is SMTP port 25, et cetera. You've heard these port numbers before. These get sent along with every packet. Again, this is a to address and a from address. The from address is actually sort of a little more mysterious. A lot of times when I'm teaching firewall classes, a lot of people are sort of uncertain or sort of surprised by this concept that every packet has a from port address. And it turns out it's actually fairly valuable, and it's one of the things that keeps firewalls, by which a firewall can keep its internal state tables straight. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Also inside an IP packet, there's lots of other stuff. There's the data payload. You know, and this is your oversized ping of death packet or whatever it is you're sending today. Error correction information, et cetera. There's an awful lot of other stuff corresponding with other layers and flags, et cetera, et cetera. But for purposes of the discussion of network address translation, the only things that are really important for us today are the to and from address for the to and from IP address and the to and from port address. So we can talk about translating some of those addresses.
Is stuff for TCP/IP or IP in general?
IP in general. Okay, so now we're going to go to hide mode outbound, the first one. Step number one. Okay, this is hide mode. You remember we have the LAN users who are sitting inside the LAN. They're protected by hide mode. They have a non-routable address. They have one of these private addresses. It's like 192.168, right? So we know already that if they send a request out to some web server on the internet using their own address, where's the web server going to reply to, right? If this packet goes out just by itself, some web server somewhere on the internet is going to get a request, an HTTP request, from somebody who's identifying themselves as being 192.168, you know, 1.2. That web server can't reply because, well, we know that you can't respond to an address like that. You can't send packets over the internet to one of those non-routable addresses. So we know already that some translation is going to have to occur here before that packet leaves your security perimeter. So the packet leaves the client. And you can see here, I've just enumerated the four sort of different embedded addresses in that packet. The first one is the IP source address is the private address. know, this is the private address of your web client there at work. The IP destination, I'm just using www.website.com. It's just a placeholder. Your web client is going to pick a random high TCP port number, and the destination is going to be port 80, and we know that because you're trying to talk to a web server. As it leaves your firewall or your NAT box, okay, this is where the network address translation comes in, your NAT box overwrites the source address with the public IP address. So you see there the IP source, we've overwritten it with a virtual public address. This is an address that you own. You've been assigned it by your ISP or by IANA, and you own it, and it routes on the internet. And the other three addresses you leave unchanged. One of the important things here is that the firewall has to store information about this connection in the state table. Because the firewall is actually sort of maintaining two different connections now, one between the internal client and the firewall, and another one between the firewall and this web server out on the internet. And you have to keep all that straight, because when the answer comes back, the firewall has to decide whether to let this in or not. So the firewall keeps a state table, just a little bit of RAM, just keeps a little piece of, just a simple little table that says, okay, this inside user at this IP address, he has an open connection going out to this web server. His real address is this. The fake external address we gave him is that. And the connection is open. He went out on this port number. So just some basic information. So the firewall keeps the state information in order to keep the channel open for the return traffic. The remote public server, this is, the website you're going to. Now, he sees a request from a valid internet host. 205.219.84.5 or whatever. That's a valid routable address. So the web server sees this and says, hey, I'm a web server. My job is to serve up web pages. I've got a valid HTTP request here from a valid internet address. So he just responds. So he sends back. Now, in a sense, it's easy to see he's just flipping the to and from on both the IP address and the port address. So he flips the two here. So this packet that leaves the server has a source address from him, which makes perfect sense. He's sending it back to the virtual public address. The port is on 80, the port source is on 80, and the destination is the original high TCP port number. Now this is sort of one of the mysteries that everyone's sort of surprised to see, is that when your replies come back from public web servers or from any web server, the two port number is the same random high TCP port number that your machine selected at the beginning. Now, since the firewall has kept that information in the table, the firewall is able to disambiguate these replies when they come back and decide who gets this packet. Okay, the question is, if you have multiple web browsers in hide mode in the same LAN, and they all want to go out and browse the web simultaneously, and they collide on high TCP port numbers, how do you resolve that? Well, the answer is, we're much more willing to take the chance they're going to collide on port numbers than on the chance that they're going to collide on outbound IP addresses, which we know they're going to collide because they're all hiding behind the same IP address. I don't know how the firewall resolves that. It probably rejects the connection and says try again. But there's 64,000 or 63,000 random high TCP port addresses, so your chances of colliding are actually very small. I would imagine if you were a firewall and the way you would keep those straight would be either to reject the second connection or maybe do something smart like keep track of, well, this guy is going to a different IP address. So when the answer comes back, you match both the IP address and the port number, and that's how you keep it straight. So I imagine if you did both of those, what are the chances of two LAN hosts simultaneously going to Yahoo, both with the same random high port number? Pretty small. Excuse me? Who would pick a different high port number? The firewall. All right, the question is it possible the firewall would just pick a second high port number going to the same destination? Right. There's something called port address translation. The firewall does have the ability to, you know, play further games with this, pick different port numbers, et cetera. The chances of this happening are very small, so it's not something, you know, we worry about a whole lot. I don't know the details of how Firewall 1 in particular, you know, resolves that. But given the fact that there are 63,000 random high TCP port numbers, and most LANs, you know, are hiding only a few hundred people behind a single, you know, NAT configuration, it doesn't seem to happen very often. I'm sure there's a solution. I'm sure they've worked on it, but I haven't considered it very much. Does the MAC address? Well, MAC addresses are local to your Ethernet segment. They don't cross routers. They don't even cross switches. So whatever MAC address you have on your local LAN client could easily be long gone by the time you get to your gateway router or your NAT box. That's layer 2 Ethernet only, doesn't have any part of this type of NAT. Question? All right, the comment is if you're using Firewall 1 in hide mode, you're always going to be using port address translation. Okay. Okay, the comment is there's no reason to be maintaining force the same port number. Okay, fine. This is not something I'm an expert on these details. I know that, you know, the firewall handles them just fine, and I haven't torn into it. The response finally comes back to the client. The client receives the reply from the internet host. So he's happy. He sent out a request to an internet server, and he got his HTTP request back, so he's perfectly happy. Number 9, he has no idea NAT was used. He has no idea that the web server thought he was really talking to 204, 205, you know, 199, one. He has no idea. And the server has no idea also. The server, as far as he knows, he received a valid request. So one of the important issues here, if NAT is working properly, is that neither the client nor the server have any idea that NAT was used, and it doesn't matter. They don't need to know, except for some unusual circumstances such as the VPN. Okay, that was outbound. Now we're going to talk about hide mode and inbound connections. And if you're thinking ahead, if you're reading ahead, you might be thinking, something's not right here. Why should there be inbound connections in hide mode? And it's true. One of the purposes of hide mode is that there can't be inbound connections. So let's say that web server you just connected to has an evil process on it, and it tries to open another connection back to your web client. Those of you who have firewalls now and watch the logs, you see this all the time. I'm running Firewall 1 in my lab right now, and I'm seeing it all the time. I connect to some web server somewhere on the internet, and 3 seconds later, there's some, you know, high TCP port attempted connection right back to my web client. My firewall drops them all and logs them, but this happens all the time. So in this scenario, the packet comes in from this website. Its destination is the public IP address, the routable one that your NAT box was using. Whatever the port source is and the port destination, if it's an evil process, it can fake it all at once. But it's coming in on something that, well, clearly you're not allowing any port numbers to come through because you're in hide mode on the LAN. The firewall sees the incoming packet and is unable to match it with a known connection described in the state table. So remember before we talked about the state table. Well, the firewall keeps information about connections that are outbound. So when packets come back in, it can look up in the table and say, oh yeah, I know about you. I was expecting you. You're the answer to this request from someone in my LAN. However, if a new connection tries to come through, the firewall looks at this and says, what is this? You're trying to connect to somebody who's in hide mode. And the firewall says, you know, my job is to hide those hosts. So the firewall says, well, this is a virtual IP address only. It's not a real IP address. We just use it temporarily for hide mode NAT. Also, here's an interesting question. Even if the firewall could forward that packet to some host inside the LAN, it's an interesting question. Which host is it intended for? There could be 200 hosts in there. Lastly, hiding the internal hosts is the whole point of hide mode. So the next issue, the next item here is, well, the next thing that happens is the connection fails, no connection can be made, hence hide mode. All right, we've talked about the first two in hide mode. I'll more quickly go through static mode. Okay, questions? Question here? Is there a cache that can be exploited from the hide mode local addresses? The only cache, so to speak, would be, my understanding, would be the state tables that are stored in the firewall. Well, sure, once the connection leaves the firewall, it's subject to all sorts of other, man-in-the-middle attacks or whatever. At that point, it's just a standard connection going out over the Internet. I suppose if you were able to, hack into that, you could get back through. But the firewall is fairly clever. I don't know all the details of what it's got there to prevent that. But the firewall is only going to allow, replies from that IP address with the correct port number and within a certain period of time. If you're hiding a couple of hundred LAN hosts in hide mode, hiding behind a single IP address on the Internet, and let's say you were sniffing that connection, you sniff somebody's T1 line going out to the Internet, what do you see? You see a single IP address that's incredibly chatty, right? You see a single IP address that's simultaneously talking to 53 websites. That's hard. That's harder. That's a real blizzard of information, and it's harder to keep all those data streams separate and tease them out and figure out who's what, and it'd be hard work. But yeah, once the connection leaves the firewall and goes out on the Internet insecurely, yes, there's some things that can be done, but the firewall is keeping a state table with all the relevant information and blocks everything that doesn't match exactly what it's expecting. The firewall is much smarter than a simple access control list, which just says, let this port number into this IP address. The firewall has a state table and says, only this connection and only for the next 30 seconds, and you have to be this IP address, you have to be this port number, otherwise you get dropped. Question? The only connection that stays open is for return HTTP information. So it has to have a source port number of 80. So there is no way, the firewall, in order to allow web traffic requests to come back to the client, has to allow web traffic requests to come back to the client. So as long as they look like that, yes, they're going to be let through. But if they come in as an attempted telnet connection, no, the port numbers are wrong, it'll get blocked. So, the firewall is only smart enough to let web traffic back, but, if there's something dangerous in that, you've attached a Trojanhorse.exe to it, well, the firewall has to do other things to protect you against that. But the connections that is opened allows web traffic responses back from that IP address until the timeout. All right, the question is that if the web server responds with the correct source IP address and the correct source port address that matches the existing connection, then the firewall will let that through. The answer is yes. That's what it does. The firewall has to do some other things in terms of further inspection of attached files, say, some much more high-level inspection, layer 7 in the packets. But for what I'm talking about here with network address translation, it's just looking at layers 3 and 4. And so if something comes back through the firewall that looks like valid web response, it's something the web server sent, then yes, it's going to let it back in. This is just simply, allowing web access from the LAN. Yes. Gentleman in the back, white shirt. All right. The question or the comment is that that there are some known and perhaps patched issues involving firewalls with buffer overflows. Yeah, those are separate issues. I'm not really trying to talk about some of the more detailed security issues here. These are just, I'm going through the basics of NAT. Yes, there are other firewall issues. Right, if you can do a buffer up overflow in a firewall, there's all sorts of things possible. Okay, we're in static mode here outbound. This is going out. The firewall overwrites the IP source address with the public IP address. So this is just like we saw in hide mode. This is the packet going outbound. Since the from IP address on this packet is a local non-routable address, the firewall has to change it on the way outbound. The question is, does the firewall accommodate a single or perhaps multiple hide addresses? My understanding with the Checkpoint Firewall One product, it's only one IP address per, say, subnet or per group or per rule. My experience with the Cisco PIX firewall is that you can designate a range of IP addresses and it will randomly select among them. That's even better. Present your opponents with, you know, 100 IP addresses and individual traffic is bouncing around between them. Sort of a spread spectrum sort of approach to it. So it depends which product you have. Firewall One, I think, typically goes with one, but I know that Cisco PIX, you can put a range in. We're going to talk about it here in a minute, but of course, any IP address that you're hiding behind for NAT has to be a public address that you own, right? You can't just pick some random IP address because then your traffic will go out, but it won't come back. The remote public server, it sees the request. It looks perfectly reasonable. It looks like a valid request. It just flips the two addresses, puts the payload in, and sends it back. This is just a standard response from a web server. Coming back in, the firewall has to do the translation again. Since it was addressed to the virtual public IP address, it now needs to be disambiguated and sent back to the correct internal address. So the moral of the story here is that your network address translation box changes one address on the way out and one address on the way in, and that's it. You just have to get the right one. The DMZ server receives the reply from the internet host, the client has no idea that NAT was used, and the server has no idea that NAT was used. So again, as long as you're using safe protocols that don't embed an IP address inside the payload, then this shouldn't be a problem. Let's do the last one here before we take the break. And again, this is going to be for people trying to connect to your inbounds, to your web servers. These are people on the internet trying to connect into your web server, your FTP server, any of your public servers. And again, here's the four addresses. It's being addressed to your virtual public address. A leading question here, where does the remote internal, the internet client get this static virtual public address? This is leading to the DNS discussion we're going to have in the next hour. If you have more than one IP address assigned to a particular TCP IP host, you have to be careful to make sure that you load up your DNS servers with the correct address depending on who's going to be querying that DNS server. So if this is a public DNS server that you want people on the internet to be able to get to your server with, then you have to make sure that you're using one of your virtual IP addresses for it, right? You don't want to load up a public DNS server with a 192.168. That won't do any good. They'll never get to you. So just I want you to just keep in mind that one of the issues you have to resolve with network address translation is how to load up your DNS servers. On the way in, the firewall overwrites the destination address with your private address. Your DMZ server sees a request from an internet host. It replies. The firewall, on the way out, this reply, the firewall has to overwrite the source address one more time, so the packet appears to be coming from a valid internet address. And lastly, the internet client out there receives the reply from the DMZ server. The client has no idea that NAT was used. The server has no idea that NAT was used. So I just wanted to enumerate here the four different types or the four different, inbound and outbound with both hide mode and static mode and just sort of step through it. It's not that complicated once you sit down with, paper and pencil and work it through. It's not that tough. You're only changing one address in each direction. And all you're doing is just maintaining the consistency that the packets have correct addresses, whether they're on the inside or the outside. The question is, how do you protect your LAN from your compromised DMZ? Well, you do it in your firewall with rules in your firewall, and that you don't allow any connections from hosts in the DMZ into hosts on the LAN. So you plan ahead, and you say, well, what if somebody totally owned my web server? What's the first thing they're going to do? Well, they're going to try to use that as a stepping stone, a springboard into the rest of your network. And at that point, the firewall is going to stop them as they're trying to connect from the inside. So this is the main reason why you want to have your DMZ and your LAN on separate NIC cards, separate LAN segments, so that the firewall has the best chance possible of still providing a defense there. Your DMZ is sort of a land where things are partially trusted. You'll let people from the outside in to some degree to get, you know, on specific port numbers, but if something on the DMZ starts trying to connect back into your LAN, you don't allow it. And so even if it's totally compromised, that's okay, because you still have a firewall protecting your inside LAN. Yes? The question is, that could be improved with a cascading firewall? Sure. Question? Is there a reason why some services don't go through a firewall, like voice? Some of the new multimedia protocols are very complex. They open up a control channel, and then they send all sorts of port number information about it, about the connection, and then they open up a whole bunch of random high TCP ports in order to send the data. Those of you who have worked with other access control lists, et cetera, you know that FTP is sort of a strange protocol, right? It's a strange, not well-behaving protocol, because once you do that port 21, port 20 thing, you get it set up, and then all of a sudden there's this discussion between the server and the client about which random high TCP port number are we going to use for the data channel. Well, if you have a static access control list, you can't prepare for that, because if somebody's picking port, 5021, well, you can't set up an access control list that you're constantly changing for that. So FTP is special. FTP is different. And that's why you need a firewall that's smart enough to understand the protocol and actually sniff the packets. And this is what this is how FTP is handled in a firewall. Is the firewall is actually sniffing the control channel and says, oh, you want port 5021 open? Well, it temporarily makes a hole in the firewall just for those IP addresses and just that port number, and only while the connection is valid. So if you're running some of these sort of the new Microsoft multimedia H323 or whatever they are, I don't know all the details. You need a firewall that understands them and can sniff the control channel and say, oh, okay, I need to open up these five high TCP ports. It has to be a dynamic, intelligent thing. You can't just set something where we're going to allow this or we're not going to allow that. It requires some real dynamic thinking going on in order to make that work. It's just about time, so I'm going to release you. We're starting again at 4 o'clock on the dot, and ask you questions here in between. Of NAT for newbies and not so newbies, we're going to run until 4:50 p.m. We have several more issues to discuss. I'm going to talk about the benefits of using NAT. I'm going to talk about some special firewall configuration issues. I'm going to talk about DNS. Questions at this point? Those of you who were here before, any lingering questions? Anything that we can talk about before we go forward? All right, the question is, even if you have NAT configured properly and you have a lot of people on your LAN who are using hide mode, the question is, what else can you do to protect yourself from what, your ISP or somebody who is sniffing your T1 line, say, and has figured out you're using NAT? Well, if you think the intrusion is only local to you, it's only between your gateway router and your ISP or something like that, go find another ISP somewhere who's willing to be the other end of a VPN and just tunnel to them. Find somebody, anybody on the internet, who's willing to be the other end of a VPN and just tunnel all of your company's traffic through that box. In other words, a VPN, just to be really clear, is an authenticated, encrypted, private channel over the public internet, over a public network. So you could have your entire company VPN through your public ISP over to somebody, anybody. Pick somebody in Australia for $20 a month. It doesn't matter. And then from there, you will emerge from the tunnel and be released out on the internet. And your ISP or anybody who's sniffing your T1 line, what do they see? They see a ton of encrypted traffic, and the value to them should be zero. So if it's local to you like that, then find another place to emerge on the internet, or find another ISP or whatever. That would be one way to do it. Other questions? Okay, I'm going to talk about the benefits of using NAT. The reason I developed this talk was because I think NAT is really cool. I think you get an awful lot of benefits for very little hassle. I find it really valuable. So there's basically four main issues here. You can hide your internal network structure from outsiders, structurally block all connections from the internet to your hosts using hide mode, preserve scarce IP addresses, and something called preventing leakage around your firewall, which we'll talk about. The first one here. Since network address translation provides the logical bridge between your internal LAN IP addresses, which you created, and your external IP addresses, which, you know, those are the ones you got from your ISP or IANA, since you can completely control what happens inside and you can completely control that logical bridging, you can do whatever you want on the inside and basically structure it so that you can control what people on the outside see. You know, on the outside you could have, you know, five IP addresses in numeric sequence, but they really represent, you know, servers that are on five different DMZ subnets. Whatever. What matters is you can completely de-link what people see on the outside from what's actually happening on the inside. You know, we talk about tools like Nmap and port scanning, et cetera, right? The whole point, if you're sort of a, you know, if you were a hacker and you're doing your basic research on some company and you were considering seeing what sort of mischief you can get up to with them, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to try to scan their public IP addresses, right? You're going to find out, well, what subnets do they have? What do they own? What domain names do they have registered? These IP addresses, okay, let's do a port scan. Okay, look, they've got a web server at these addresses. They respond to FTP at these addresses. Ooh, look, there's one of their mail servers, right? This is easy stuff. This is public information, basically. But the nice thing is, if you're using NAT, then getting all of that public external information gives you zero information about what's happening inside. So this is the main benefit of NAT, is you can make the outside look like whatever you want, and it's completely orthogonal to what's happening on the inside. There's absolutely no relation at all. Question? Okay, the question is, you've got a NAT box running, which is also serving as an FTP server? Well, okay, well, I guess I'd start off by saying that's a bad idea. You should, you know, move your FTP server into the DMZ. I mean, FTP is notorious, you know. I mean, in my lab, my FTP server got ransacked 2 months ago through FTP. So I'm here to tell you, I don't like FTP. It's a bad thing to be serving. So, no, you don't want somebody to be able to do something evil with FTP and then gain control of your NAT box. Oh, man, you just gave them the keys. So, first of all, separate those out. Make your NAT box firewall just a NAT box firewall. In fact, strip that thing down so there's nothing on it except your NAT and your firewall. So if I'm going to I'll rephrase your question. If you do have a FTP server inside and you're making it available to outsiders using, say, static mode NAT, yeah, people can tell that you've got, you know, people do a port scan, they will be able to tell, yeah, there's an FTP server there at that IP address. That's what you want. You're making it public. I mean, that's why you have an FTP server. So Yes, if you want people to be able to connect to your mail server, web server, FTP server, then yes, if they do a port scan, they will see those ports open. That's the point. But you've limited it to exactly which IP addresses you want and exactly which port numbers you want, and you're not giving away any information about the inside structure. All you're giving away is that somewhere in your organization there's an FTP server, but who knows what that address is? It's probably a private, non-routable inside address, right? I mean, nobody, you know, you're not giving away anything. You're giving away the fact that an FTP site exists at your company, but you've already told people that, so that's not giving away anything more. Other questions? Okay, so this is the main benefit of NAT, is you can completely decouple your internal structure from your external structure, say your external IP structure. So let script kiddies do all the port scanning they want. All they're going to find out is that, yeah, your company has a web server. Duh. They're going to find out, yeah, your company has an FTP server. You're a genius. And you've got a mail server. All right, you're still a genius. That okay, doesn't do them any good. So your public IP address structure is designed independently of your internal structure. Another benefit to NAT. Hosts protected by hide mode don't have a public IP address. This is crucial. In the previous hour, we talked about in hide mode how someone can try to make a connection into one of the machines on your LAN. Well, the machines on your LAN don't have a public IP address. Okay, this is even better than an access control list. This is even better than a router or a firewall saying, we're not going to allow people to connect to this particular IP address with this port number. It's even better because this IP address doesn't even exist. I mean, this is much better than access control list. This is, you've made an architectural change, or it's being completely blocked by architecture. They can't even tell that those machines exist. Somebody on the outside could be pinging that machine all day long. Well, first of all, what address would they ping? Well, there is no address they could ping. So you can't even get started. So that's a real benefit. A third benefit to network address translation is to preserve scarce IPv4 IP addresses. How many people here have heard of something called IPv6 coming along real soon now? Okay, any year now. I know we're working on it. Back when the internet, you know, was first starting, you know, the concept of a 32-bit IP address, that is such a vast IP address space, nobody thought we'd ever run out. Well, clearly we're running out. Same thing about 20 meg hard drives, right? I mean, if a guy like me can have 16 IP addresses in his house, you know, we're going to run out soon. So there are only 128 Class A IP address blocks. That's all there are. There are only 32,000 Class Bs and only about 8 million Class Cs. We're running out. I'll show you some examples here of people, you know, sort of grabbing more than they needed. There's some humorous examples here we'll get to. But the fact is, there just aren't enough. I mean, every organization who's bigger than five people is going to claim they want their own Class B, and there just aren't enough to go around. Non-market allocation adds to scarcity. IP addresses, once they're assigned, they tend to have fairly strong squatter's rights. So once your company gets a Class B or a Class A, you tend to hold on to it and resist people taking it from you. And we'll see here some examples. One of the reasons we tend to be running out of IP address blocks. And also routing table restrictions. The central core routers on the internet have to have routing table entries for basically every single valid IP address in the world. And my understanding, I'm sure there's someone in this room who knows this better than I, but my understanding just a year or two ago, I read an article saying, well, it's bigger than 64 megs now and approaching 128, and it's really causing a problem because a lot of those routers only have 128 megs. Well, first of all, imagine how difficult it is for a router to dynamically search through a 128 megabyte routing cable to figure out which NIC it should send this packet out on. So the more IP addresses you have out there and the more fragmented they become, the harder it is to keep straight where you route things. Because a router on the central part of the internet, you know, has to be able to handle pretty much every packet that comes its way. Okay, let's talk about squatter's rights. This is interesting stuff. I was getting curious about who owns all the Class A address blocks. These are 1 through 127, I guess 0 through 127. Here's some of them. 40. If you ever see a packet coming from 40, you can thank Eli Lilly and Company. Now, what are Eli Lilly and Company doing with the full Class A address block? I don't know. That makes them equivalent to Sprint, I think, in terms of how many IP addresses they have. This is stupid. Prudential Securities, EI DuPont, Merck, Boeing. I mean, Boeing, give me a break. I mean, you know, with a Class B, you could give an IP address to every seat on every plane Boeing has ever sold, I think. So, another one here, which I think recently got yanked, was Mercedes-Benz had 53. You know, I like Mercedes-Benz, but, you know, I'm pretty sure that if I were allowed to use NAT, I could hide any one of these companies behind a Class C address block, right? I mean, for any size company, I mean, how many public IP addresses do you need? A couple of web servers, a couple of mail servers, a couple of FTP servers, right? How many do you need? 10, 12? And then maybe one hide address for me to hide the rest of your people behind? Maybe a range, but still, I'm willing to bet if you let me spend money on hardware like I want to, I could hide any corporation in America behind a single Class C IP address block. You don't need, however, 16 million or some ridiculous number of IP addresses. So I'm looking here at number 48, Prudential Securities. They got it in May of 1995. Well, everyone talks about 1995 as the year the Internet really took off. It looks like they just got in under the wire. This is from my looking through IANA's website, this is the last corporate Class A giveaway. Some lucky guys there over at Prudential pulling down a whole Class A for the company. Now it would be a whole lot harder. So, as you can see, if these guys like Eli Lilly can grab a whole Class A, you know, obviously we're not allocating IPv4 addresses very efficiently, and this is one of the reasons we're running out. So here, back to that. So the reason you're able to use NAT to preserve scarce IP addresses is because all of your internal machines have private non-routables, and then the only ones that you need for the outside are the static addresses that you're using for people to come to your servers and the hide mode addresses that you're using. So almost any company could turn in their Class A if they wanted to and pick up a Class C and probably do just fine. Another benefit of NAT, number 4, is preventing leakage around your firewall. How many people here are sort of network administrators or sysadmins or something like that, or you're in charge of a network in some organization? How many people have had somebody in your organization, they get either a dial-up account at their desk, or they get a ricochet modem, or they get some other way to connect to the Internet, and before you know it, they're starting to route internal LAN packets through their private connection. Has that happened to anybody here? It's a real issue that, you know, somebody at work, well, as we all know, the most dangerous thing in the world is a helpful engineer with a screwdriver. But let's say you get somebody at your office who's sick and tired of not being able to get through the firewall to do whatever he wants. So he gets a dial-up account, and he gets a modem line in his office, and he starts dialing out. Well, let's say he's running Windows NT Server. He accidentally checks the forward packets box, and what do you know? He's got a server connected to the Internet without protection, and now he's routing between the Internet and your LAN, and it's not going through your firewall. Well, this is real trouble. So one of the things that network address translation does for you is it helps prevent this leakage. I call this leakage. If you're setting up a security perimeter and you've got your firewall, I mean, the whole point is that all of the traffic has to go through that checkpoint, right? If some of your traffic is leaking around your firewall or your NAT box, well, that's not very secure because you can be sure hackers are going to be leaking back, leaking back in the other direction. So this is not good. So if you force all of your traffic, well, if you use network address translation, then you're forcing all of your traffic to go through the NAT box. You can't leak around it because your addresses aren't any good. So since the state tables on your NAT box are private to your NAT box, and since, therefore, nobody else can get in there and sort of figure out what's going on, if somebody does leak, the private address they have is worthless on the outside. So let's say somebody with a machine with a 192.168 dials up somewhere and connects to somebody and starts routing. Well, that 192.168 isn't going anywhere, right? It's a private non-routable address. That's the point. It's worthless on the Internet. Public addresses are worthless on the inside because they have to go through the network address translation. And traffic that leaks around the firewall has senseless IP address translation. So One of the nice things about NAT is that you, not perfectly, but fairly effectively, ruin the effectiveness of any traffic that tries to leak around your firewall. This is Windows 98. It's taking a little time here. Up here I have, I brought 50 copies, which clearly isn't enough, a printout of the presentation. So if you want, why don't you come out and grab one now? Oh, yeah, by the end of the presentation I'll show you here. This presentation is already posted on the internet. Okay, the fifth issue here. Let's talk about just some basics, how to configure a firewall for NAT. Because NAT is usually done through a firewall. You know, if someone's going to go through the trouble of writing, designing, coding a firewall, adding NAT is fairly easy. So you should get them as a bundle. I know that Checkpoint Firewall 1, you get NAT with it for free, as they say. And Cisco PIX has NAT also. The question is, what about the cheap personal hardware firewalls like Linksys and D-Link? They're great. You know, hey, for $300, geez, you can't go wrong. It's not perfect. You can't do all sorts of crazy configuration stuff. You know, you can't get Microsoft NetMeeting to go through it or something. But man, I strongly recommend everybody have a personal firewall of some sort if you're going to connect to the internet. And D-Link or Linksys, these guys, you know, out of Taiwan that make great stuff, really inexpensive. It works. I got a couple of them at home. I'm sorry. What about Black Ice? Black Ice didn't. I think Steve Gibson's website. I think he definitively proves it's worthless. So go with something. In his opinion, go with something else. Zone Alarm is very good. Yes. Do what? Do hardware firewalls and NAT boxes like the D-Link or the Linksys, do they add much network overhead? I think you're really asking, do they add much latency? No, undetectable, milliseconds, not a problem. It's in hardware. It's a, you know, it's an ASIC. The announcement is that many of those boxes have NAT only and do not have firewall. You're saying the Netgear in particular does have firewall? Okay, the Netgear box includes some rules-based firewall technology from SonicWall. One of the ones I use is a D-Link box that also provides my wireless, my 802.11b Wi-Fi connection. It is a wireless node and NAT box and firewall with rules together for, I don't know, $230, something like that. Whatever, the price is falling, you can't go wrong. You know, get one that has firewall and NAT. Other questions? The question is, am I going to address circumvention of NAT device? No. This is designed for newbies. This is a tutorial so that the goal is that at the end of this you have more confidence and information about setting up NAT rather than confidence and information about cracking it. That's the next hour. We're meeting at a bar downtown. So I hate to be so simplistic here to say that, you know, in order to configure NAT on your firewall, the first step should be document your network. But it's awfully important to do that. If you don't know what you have, you don't know where you're going, and it's sometimes a lot of work to really figure out what you've got. You know, I use what I call the pre-beta version of Visio, Visio 0.9, which is a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper and a pencil, and I draw and I make the diagram, and I draw in my, you know, I draw in all my subnets and everything, and it works just fine. It I got to tell you, it's actually more complex than you think to really sit down and diagram what you've got. You have to be really clear. You have to know what are your IP subnets here. You know, what are the default gateways? What are the subnet masks? You know, you got to learn all that technology. You know, you have to learn all that terminology. You know, 255.255.248. What does that mean? Got to figure that out. So that's the first part. Document your network. Number two, make a plan. Figure out where you want to be. If you're going to be instituting NAT for the first time, there's actually some substantial changes you need to make to your network. You're changing all of your internal IP addresses. One of the technical things we've got to talk about here is ARP issues. Just briefly, ARP is a layer 3, layer 2 protocol called Address Resolution Protocol. This is how you convert layer 3 addresses into Ethernet addresses. Think of it as a vending machine. You put in a layer 3 address, and what you get out is a layer 2 address. If somebody's on your local area network and you want to talk to them through Ethernet, because that's how you talk to somebody on your LAN, and you know their IP address but not their Ethernet address, you send out an ARP broadcast. You say, yo, anybody out there on this IP address? And whoever has it answers back and gives you his Ethernet address. Whatever. We're going to talk about ARP here in a minute, but it's a technical detail you need to know. It's sort of one of the few things we need to talk about down at layer 2. Also, we have to talk about routing issues. Because if you're changing all of your IP addresses, well, clearly you have to change all your routing setups. Also, there's a special thing you have to worry about here. Your firewall is a router first and has a bad attitude second, right? That's what a firewall is. It's a router first with an added bad attitude. And when you're setting up your router, when you're setting up your firewall, let's say if you're doing Checkpoint Firewall 1, you know, and it sits on top of a Solaris box or an NT box, you know, you want to get your NT box up and running first and make sure you can route through it first before you add the firewall and start dropping packets. So keep that in mind. You know, a firewall is just a router with some advanced sophisticated access control lists and similar types of things. So it's an interesting question. If a packet is coming into your network, and it needs to be NATed, say static mode, and while it's in that NAT box, its to address for IP, it gets changed, right? It gets changed from the virtual public IP address into the private one. Well, that brings up an interesting question about routing, because, you know, where you route a packet is based entirely upon what is the to address of that packet. So now you have a packet whose address, you know, its mailing address is changing. So there's issues we have to go over here. We have to talk about, you know, exactly how do you handle that? How do you route a packet whose address is changing dynamically on you? Would you route it to the public one? Do you route it to the private one? Do you route first and NAT second? Do you NAT first? Whatever. We'll talk about that. Oh, I'm locked up. I should have used Linux. Thank you. Oh, here we go. I have this wireless LAN card here. I'm probably being hacked. We should expect messages coming up on the screen here any minute. Can somebody return one of the printouts, please? Thank you. Ha, ha, ha. Well, unfortunately, this machine... Oh, here we go. I just got some action. Okay, this is the next slide, so I'm going to try to continue on this. If not, I can use the whiteboard. In terms of documenting your network, as I said, this is really just the basics. IP addresses, subnets, gateways, routers, firewalls, all connections through the security perimeter. Again, I'm just talking about documenting what do you have, just so you know what you've got currently going. I guess I'm going to continue to speak to the next slide while it slowly comes up here. Making a plan. The main issues are just what are your public and your private IP addresses, whatever your documentation is, your hand drawing, or et cetera. You need to have it at least as detailed for what you're doing going forward. And your NAT rules, you need to figure out in advance what are you going to do in terms of which machines are going to be in the LAN and are going to have hide mode network address translation, and which machines are going to be in your DMZ and have static mode. Man, this is annoying. I hate to reboot because it just takes forever on this machine. I'm waiting for my mouse to come back. Huh? Yeah, that's next on my list. The question is, let's talk about DNS issues. DNS issues are three slides away. We've already been over a VPN. In case you missed the first hour, there was a question about VPN, about VPN compatibility with network address translation. It's the one sort of barely resolved issue. VPN, network address translation works best with well-behaved protocols that do not embed the IP address inside the payload of the packet. Because network address translation, your NAT box is changing your IP address as these packets go in and out of your security perimeter. So a well-behaved protocol, that doesn't matter, they don't care. They only look in the packet itself for the IP to and from destination and rely on that. VPNs are special because they've added some security issues in there. They've added some security protections in that they actually embed the IP address in the payload or encrypt it and embed it. And so you can get some problems because on the other end of your VPN, it sees a packet coming from one IP address, and yet the inside embedded information gives a different IP address. So there are still issues with VPNs and network address translation. The best solution is to use an integrated firewall that has both network address translation and VPN, and that issue will be resolved by itself. Yes? What about hardware VPN? I'm not able to really give a recommendation one way or the other. There's a lot of different solutions. IPsec has emerged as the standard, so if someone is using IPsec, you should be fine. Yes? The question is, I've talked about web servers, FTP servers, mail servers as being servers that you want available to people on the outside, on the internet, and that you put them in the DMZ because of it. And the question is, does the same thing apply to SQL servers? You have SQL servers outside your firewall. Well, ask the hackers who own that SQL server to do that for you. I mean, whatever. You have SQL servers outside the firewall that need to talk back to some. I guess I don't understand the configuration. Why do you have SQL servers outside the firewall? My server, my laptop at home, and I can talk about that stuff. Well, SQL uses, you know, as you mentioned, the standard port numbers, where you can configure that with your firewall or with your access control list in your router to allow or not allow those port numbers. And I think you can actually change those port numbers. But if you want to allow someone on the internet access to your, you know, whatever server, put it in your DMZ and put the appropriate holes in the firewall. It's no different. Yeah, there's no difference between, you know, SQL Server or web server. It's a little strange to make that accessible to someone in the outside world. It sounds a little risky, but there shouldn't be any difference. Excuse me? Okay. Question, yes. Okay, the question involves some complicated interactions between NAT and VPN. I guess in particular using a cable modem at home and trying to use VPN to get back into work. Those interactions are a lot more, oh, I love this, are a lot more complicated than, well, it looks like we've got an hour now, don't we? Yeah. Here comes safe mode, I bet. It's a complicated interaction between. I'm so embarrassed. It's a complicated interaction between NAT and VPN. I'm not prepared to get into the details on it. That's a lot tougher problem to solve. What kind of box were you? What kind of NAT box were you using? OpenBFD. Okay. 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 Other questions? Yes. Do ISPs use NATing? It's a public. Okay. The question is. The question is, you went to a Steve Gibson's website. You tested the Shields Up thing, and it reported back that you were on a private network. Congratulations, and this was news to you. Are you on a public IP address? It looks like a regular. Is it possible that your ISP is doing some firewalling for you and protecting some of those port numbers? But it might be that, well, you've got a public routable IP address, and I've never heard of an ISP issuing non-routables to anybody. So, I don't know. You've got an ISP for dial-up who gives you non-routables? Really? Oh, sorry to hear that. Other questions? Yes?
So I just assume that all companies use NAT. Am I wrong?
The question is, should I assume?
I've always assumed.
This sounds like a hacker question. All right, the question is, you've always assumed most companies use NAT, and now I guess I'm talking here sort of implying that not all companies use NAT and maybe they should get with the program. I don't really know. I think there's a lot of companies, I mean, all the companies I've worked for, I mean, everybody is desperately short of time and resources. And if a company's been around for a long time and they've got public addresses and it seems to work and you know, they haven't been hacked severely recently, there's no incentive for people to change that. If you, you know, if you're Eli Lilly and Company and you've got a Class A and you want to preserve your squatter's rights, what are you going to do? You're going to make as much use of those addresses as you can, right? You're going to, you know, you're not going to hide behind a single Class C and then sit around and wait for someone to grab that Class A out of your hands, right? You're going to make as much use of that as you can. The coffee pot at Eli Lilly has its own IP address. So, I don't know. I don't really know how to really answer that question. I suspect there's an awful lot of organizations out there who many years ago got the network working once and then dropped it and went on to other emergencies and haven't been back. You know, that's how things get typically configured, right? You get it working once, and then it's not your most important five-alarm fire, and so you don't get back to it. And well, you know, everyone's getting on the internet and no one's complaining, and I got to do something else. I don't have time. So I suspect there's lots of companies out there who have firewalls who aren't using NAT, and I imagine so, but I don't have data on it. Yes, question. This is a good observation that converting IP addresses or switching IP addresses at your organization is a real pain, and you're exactly right. You sort of have to do it in one swell swoop. It's a lot of work. It's a long, bad weekend, and there's a lot of ways to go wrong on it. I'll talk about that a little bit. If you're a company who's already got a few thousand users set up with public IP addresses, who wants the headache of converting them over to private? I completely agree. Yes?
You went through that situation at Delta Airport with about 3,000 people in the company and switched IP for whatever reason. And it took 3 days to actually do all the IP shifts and all the machines and everything. And then on top of that, there was engineering that was involved in it. So, yes.
Okay, so here's a war story up here about it took 3 days to change IP addresses when you changed ISPs. If you were using private IP addresses and you change ISPs, you only have to reconfigure your NAT box because none of your internal addresses change, just your external ones. You get a new Class C from Bob's ISP, you're up and running in 10 minutes, right? It's not that tough. Another real benefit of going with NAT. Yes?
This leads to my question. If you have a home network and you have a dynamically assigned public number from a dial-up connection, but a small home network, how much trouble is that to maintain that private?
So the question is, what if you have a NAT box and on the outside, the public IP address side of it, you're using a DHCP address, an address that's dynamically given to you by your internet service provider. Traditionally, typically, from what I've seen in NAT boxes, you have to hard code in the external IP address. But this is trouble if you're getting it dynamically. The new boxes now allow for that. I think my D-Link Wi-Fi hub, it's a combination of a switch, a firewall, a NAT box, and a coffee maker, I think. And it's got, I think you can do DHCP on the outside. So new hardware will allow that. Checkpoint Firewall 1, I don't think so at this point. So there's a need for that, and it's easy to code it, so expect it soon. Question? But the suggestion is a way that you can incrementally walk your company through a major IP address change. and that is if you've broken your network up into subnets, you can do them one at a time and use NAT boxes and have the outside of the NAT box still be in the old regime, while the inside or the downside, excuse me, the inside of the NAT box with the LAN, that they're all going to be on the new addresses. So if you're thinking cleverly through it and you're willing to go through some of that, yeah, you can sort of walk your way through one LAN at a time, and then maybe at the end there's a bad weekend where you have to sort of yank all those out or do something else. But, yeah, you can incrementally work your way through. It's still a headache. There's still going to be problems, and Monday morning people are still going to be calling you and they're going to be mad. Yes, in the back. Okay, another tip here. DHCP is particularly helpful. Those of you who haven't discovered it yet, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, it's a great way to propagate network changes through your network and your users don't even know. I need to move on. We're only got about 7 or 8 minutes left, so I'm going to try to make some more tracks here. Windows 98 seems to be... I spoke too soon. There we go. Okay, we talked about making a plan. Back to address resolution protocol. If you're going to be using on the outside of your NAT box FACO IP addresses, these are virtual public IP addresses. But for example, this is really an issue, say, on a checkpoint firewall on Solaris or on Windows NT. If you're going to be using external public IP addresses that aren't native to that box, you have to make sure that that box will respond properly to ARP broadcasts from your router. If you have a gateway router who's trying to find this virtual IP address, you have to ensure that the outside of your NAT box is going to respond to the ARP broadcasts and announce itself properly as being the Ethernet host for that IP address. A lot more complicated details. In Firewall 1, you handle it in two different ways, depending if you're on Solaris or if you're on Windows NT. Just keep in mind you have to get that straight. On routing, as I mentioned, a firewall is a router first, and it's a firewall second. Important question, how do you route a packet whose IP destination is changing, since routing is based upon what is your IP destination? So the question sort of falls down to this, which comes first, the routing or the NATing? And it depends on your firewall, you have to figure this out. With Checkpoint, the routing comes first, and the NATing is the very last thing that happens as the packet flies out the door. So you have to route to the correct NIC first, whether it's the LAN or the DMZ, and then just as it's leaving, the very last step is the destination address gets changed. So it can go either way. You can route first or you can NAT first. You just have to find out what it is in your firewall and make sure you understand that. But keep in mind, you're trying to route a packet that has a dynamically changing destination address, and as you can imagine, that can get tricky if you get it wrong. DNS issues. Here's the problem. If you have two different IP addresses for a given host, one on the inside and one on the outside, which IP address should be returned with the DNS query? Users on the inside, they need to get DNS resolved to the inside address. Users on the outside need to get DNS resolved to the outside address. So the question is, which answer should DNS resolve? If you've got in your DMZ, you have www.company.com, and you're inside on the LAN, and you go to, you set your browser to www.company.com, you resolve DNS. Well, which address do you want to resolve to, the outside one or the inside one? Here's the answer. You have to have something called split DNS. You need to maintain both an inside and an outside DNS server. Insiders resolve to the inside, outsiders resolve to the outside, and you limit the number of entries in the outside DNS server to just the minimum required. So this is an additional enhanced security. You don't want people on the outside to use NS lookup and just run through all the tables on your DNS server and figure out all your internal machines, right? That wouldn't be good. So you list the five boxes that are in your DMZ. You list their public IP addresses, and outsiders can see that. But in terms of all the inside machines, you use inside DNS, and so that enhances your security by keeping the, again, you're hiding the internal structure of your network from outsiders. Okay, a summary here. NAT provides security at the network architecture level. That's one of the reasons I think it's so good. It's below and before you get issues like access control lists. How many people here have screwed up an ACL and accidentally let something through they shouldn't or accidentally blocked something they shouldn't have? I better see every hand go up if you've ever touched a router. People do it all the time. It's much harder to screw up NAT. Well, once you get NAT working the first time, then it's harder to get it wrong later. It provides security at a structural level. The nice thing is all the machines in your hide mode, all the machines on your LAN, they don't even have public IP addresses. So the question of whether somebody from the outside can connect to it is sort of moot. I've talked here about the many benefits of NAT. Sort of a warning, a caveat. It may require some significant restructuring of your network. It's some real work to do IP address changes in your company, but I believe the benefits are pretty darn nice if you can get a chance to pull it off. Where to get more information is the Internet Engineering Task Force. This is my company, Information Engine. This presentation is already posted on the site. If you go to informationengine.com, you see a section called DEF CON 9, and you can find my PowerPoint presentation here. I'm going to do some more Q&A, and this is about us. It's sort of a one-man corporation. I'm definitely looking for more interesting opportunities. I have resumes up here. You know how to get to my website. Talk to me if you wish. And in the few minutes we have left, actually about 2 minutes, more questions, and I'll handle more questions when we're done here until we lose the room. Thank you.